Captain Felicent Del Grille, 8. Now, so your next posting was back to HMS Vernon at Portsmouth, I believe. This would be June 1948. You went after a period of leave, and you were there till November 49. Now, you were on the instructional staff again, and this time the notes say tactics. Could you explain what you were doing?
Well, there was one section of HMS Vernon was known as the tactical section, and it taught torpedo tactics. And they had it at Vernon the most astonishing training aid called the Action Speed Tactical Teacher, which is an electronic machine filling most of a room where you could play tactical games, as you might call them, at action speed. It was staffed by a lot of Wrens who were extremely good at it, and you could train about 6 ships at a time, if I remember rightly, in coordinated torpedo tactics.
Can you just explain a bit how it worked at all?
I don't think I could, quite honestly. It was very complicated. It took quite a long time to learn to operate it. It took about, I think, 3 or 4 of us to operate it, one representing the submarine, controlling the aircraft, and so forth. But there were little booths, or little rooms, each one representing a ship. And you put in the captain and the torpedo officer and the signals officer and so forth. And they had an automatic plotting table which showed what their ship was doing. And they received information, synthetic information, showing what their colleagues in other ships were doing. And the whole thing was plotted on the most enormous Perspex screen, about 20 foot by 12 foot, I should think, by these Wrens. And at the end of the game, the Wrens would draw in all the lines showing where every ship had gone, and so you could analyze the state of play of the action. There was subsequently a very much bigger teacher of the same sort at the Naval Tactical School at Woolwich, where I served.
How realistic was this?
No sort of sounds of gunfire, nonsense like that. No, it was entirely in the calm of an operations room.
No, what I mean is, I don't mean to the noises off. As a training exercise, how realistic was it in recreating the sort of tactics?
It was very good indeed, very good. As I say, such as they built an enormous big one at the Tactical School at Woolwich, which was used by not only the Royal Navy, but other foreign navies who came over for instruction from us.
Now, what were the essences of the tactics you were learning? What were the tactics? What were the principles, tactical principles you were trying to get across?
There were various forms of torpedo attack in those days. There was one called the star attack, where you attempted to attack from a lot of different directions to make the avoidance problem more difficult for your target. Another sort of attack was that perhaps in defense of some major unit, where you had to place yourself, if you could, between the unit you were protecting and the enemy who was trying to attack you. I think the sort of juxtaposition of things that rather passed by there, where you steamed in a long line parallel to the enemy. But one could simulate, for example, a few destroyers meeting up with a German raider, something like that, and dealing with it. Perhaps a rather clever raider which could do, 20 knots or more, and was highly maneuverable, and you had to decide how you were going to attack him, and do so, synthetically. And afterwards you could then analyze what you'd done wrong, and see where the mistakes had been.
Now, were these tactics new? Were these tactics that were being developed at the Vernon, or were these the experience of war?
They were both. They were experiences of war embellished by Vernon. And the chief, my boss, was a most brilliant officer called John Adams, who eventually retired as a Rear Admiral.
He'd be a captain then, would he?
No, he was a lieutenant commander then. But obviously, going for stardom, he became the first executive officer of the new Britannia, the Royal Yacht.
Now, what was so special about John Adams?
Enthusiasm for his job, I think, and very, very sound and deep knowledge of it, and great personal charm. As I say, he became an admiral, and he retired in protest about the abolition of the aircraft carriers. I met him. He's still alive, or was until very recently. A man of great charm and distinction.
And he was in command of
He was in charge of the tactical section.
Tactical section, sorry, yeah. Yes, that's why I was on
yeah. the
Who was in charge of the whole thing at the time?
The captain of the Vernon was a captain called Nicholas Copeman, C-O-P-E-M-A-N, Copeman. Who again was a man of great charm. And he was succeeded by a captain, John Grant, DSO. But he was only there a short time with me before I left.
Now, anything in particular happened to you while you were there? You were there until November 49.
No, I think nose to the grindstone, really. We were quite hard worked. Quite hard worked. No, nothing out of the ordinary.
Were you doing courses for foreign students still?
We did some of foreign students. Commonwealth students at that stage. We did foreign ones at the Woolwich Tactical School.
And how did they fit in?
Well, being Commonwealth officers, they do all about us and the Navy and the customs of the service were the same as ours, of course.
Was this sort of Australia, Canada?
Oh, yes.
Not so much India?
Oh, no. Old Commonwealth.
And so what would the next thing be then? I think it's Osprey.
Well, I went down to Osprey to qualify in anti-submarine warfare.
HMS Osprey is another...
It's down at Portland. It's a training establishment at Portland. And they had some ships attached to them which used to go out and practice attacks against submarines.
Now, why as an anti-submarine officer? Was this another string to your bow, or was this something that was expected of a torpedo?
No. I started off as a Lieutenant T for torpedoes, but I had to become eventually Lieutenant brackets TAS for torpedo anti-submarine. They merged the two branches, which hitherto had been separate. And so when I had finished the course at HMS Osprey...
Now, what do you remember of the course? What exactly were you learning?
Well, quite a lot of the theory of the ESDIC, or the sonar, as it's called today, and a lot of seagoing. They had a squadron of frigates down there and some tame submarines, and used to go out in the channel and do practice attacks on these until you got better. It all weathers.
Anything new from your days? You know, you've done this before.
No, nothing particular, but it was interesting and hard work. Only one little incident I remember. We had two very highly decorated officers on our course. One was Lieutenant Peter Roberts, who had got a Victoria Cross in the submarine in the Mediterranean during the war. And the other was Lieutenant Commander Christopher Dreyer, who had a DSO and two DSCs, I think, which he got very largely in coastal forces during the war. And again, we had these sort of tactical games, floor games, they used to call them, which the Wrens used to do. And I saw one of these wrens looking intently at Peter Roberts. And eventually she plucked up courage and went up to him and said, what's that first medal ribbon you've got there? And he said, it's the Victoria Cross. And he said, oh, go on, you couldn't get a Victoria Cross. And Peter Roberts didn't sort of react to this at all, and she wandered away. But I could see that a worm of doubt was at work in this wren's mind, and eventually she could contain herself no longer, and she went up to Christopher Dreyer and said, what's that first medal ribbon that the officers wear? He says, the VC. She burst into tears and left the room in a hurry. Poor girl. But there, but Peter Roberts was such a sort of modest officer. He didn't look the sort of swashbuckling type, which indeed he wasn't. He was a very, very gallant submariner, and got his VC, I think, in the Thrasher, for heaving overboard a bomb which was lodged in the casing of the submarine. And of course, if they'd been surprised by an aircraft, he'd have to dive, and Peter Roberts would have been dug round. And he and a petty officer both got the VC for it.
They both got a VC. After the Osprey, unless there's anything else by the Osprey, I think then you were lieutenant aboard HMS Duke of York.
That's right.
From June 50 to May 52, another major commission there.
Well, she didn't go to sea, the Duke of York. She was the headquarters ship, or the flagship, of the flag officer commanding the whole of the reserve fleet. And we had an enormous reserve fleet in those days at various ports around England. And my job under him was to deal with the maintenance and efficiency, everything else, of the torpedo and anti-submarine equipment of all the ships in reserve.
And the Duke of York was at?
She was a battleship.
Where was she?
At Portsmouth. Portsmouth.
What were your impressions of the Duke of York? As a ship.
Well, she was enormous. She was bigger than the Rodney, which had been the biggest I'd sailed in up to then. But very comfortable, of course. and I had a large office. I was living with my wife at Bedhampton, so I didn't sleep on board, except when I was a duty boy. But no, she was an enormous ship. But it was rather sad to be in this great ship, which would never fire its guns again or even turn its engines again.
She was a harbour ship.
Well, not a hull, but she was kept smart and clean. But she was never going to be of any use again, except as an office block.
Now, what about your job?
I had to travel around the UK to all the various ports where they had ships in reserve, which was Chatham and Sheerness and Harwich and the Clyde and Devonport, Portsmouth, of course. And Chatham, and go on board these ships and make sure that those who were responsible for looking after them were looking after the underwater weapons were doing their job properly. So I would report to the senior officer of the Reserve Fleet Division and go around the various ships. I used to choose different ones each time and then report back to him whether all was well or not well, as the case may be.
Now, what were you looking for? What would be good and what would be bad?
Well, I was looking at the standard of preservation, mainly. I laid down what you should, the method you should use for dealing with these ships out of commission, so far as underwater weapons are concerned. And so I merely went around to see that my instructions, which I'd written, were being observed. Or not, as the case may be.
And were they or weren't they?
Pretty well, they were, yes. Very few cases of non-compliance.
Did you have a title? I mean, I'm not quite... Were you the underwater specialist?
I was the Fleet TAS officer of the Reserve Fleet. On the staff of the flag officer.
Torpedo anti-submarine.
Yeah, that's right, yep.
And anything happened while you were there?
No, nothing. The Duke of York eventually was turned over to the Cleopatra, which performed the same function. And she flew the flag of Admiral McCall, Sir Henry McCall, who in fact had commanded her... No, not Cleopatra, I'm sorry, the Dido. He had commanded her during the war in the Mediterranean. So he was rather pleased to fly his flag again in the ship which he'd commanded 70 years before.
And so you were on the Dido for a while?
That's right, yeah.
But again, same job, same routine.
Same job, same routine.
What was your next posting then?
Next was to the Cossack in the Far East. She was the leader of the 8th Destroyer Squadron. And I joined her in Hong Kong. And we sailed almost immediately after Japan, because it was, of course, during the time of the Korean War.
Now, were you the TAS officer?
I was the TAS officer for the whole squadron of destroyers, yes.
Now, what was the situation? What was your impression? Well, first, let's look at the Cossack itself. What did you think of the Cossack?
She was obviously a very well-run and efficient ship, first of all. She had a very tough captain called Wally Adair, and he stood no nonsense. If you knew your job, if you stood up to him managed to have the same sort of sense of humour as him, that was fine. If you were idle, didn't know your job, then God help you. He was merciless. As a result of which, we were a very, very efficient ship.
So you thought he was a good captain?
Fine. He had the same sense of humour as me, luckily. Oh, I learned his sense of humour, which is probably more important.
What was his sense of humour? What did he like?
Well, it's difficult. Unless you know the chap, it's very difficult. No, he could be absolutely ruthless with anything that went wrong, but you'd have followed him to the end of the world.
Now, what about the Cossack? What did you think of the Cossack? Was this a newer ship or the old Cossack? I'm not sure.
No, she wasn't the one that Vian did all his exploits in. No, it was a successor. She was a C-class destroyer, one of about eight of the C-class, and very conventional, single funnel, four guns, torpedo tubes.
Well laid out?
Oh, yes, very conventional sort of destroyer.
So nothing special?
No, what did you expect? Nothing special.
Now, were you aware of what was going on in the Korean War? I mean, could you sketch out the situation as you saw it?
Well, we were based either at Sasebo, which was run, that is in Japan, which was run by the Americans, or at Kure, K-U-R-E, which was run by the Commonwealth navies. We preferred to go to the Commonwealth place, to Kure, and we would go there in between patrols. Normally we would patrol in the Yellow Sea, that's in the western side of the Korean Peninsula, either screening the aircraft carrier, which was either American or British, or else patrolling close inshore and bombarding certain Korean positions.
Well, let's look at the screening the aircraft carrier first.
Very boring indeed. The aircraft carrier was engaged in fighter bomber strikes against shore targets in North Korea. What the targets were, I don't know, but gun positions, troop positions, so forth. We never knew what their targets were.
And what was perceived to be the threat to the aircraft carrier? You know, I mean, how would they attack it?
Well, they had one or two submarines. We never saw or got a smell of them. And I only saw one aircraft, one enemy aircraft, one MiG, in the entire time I was out there. So the answer is not an enormous amount. But you never know with submarines. They can turn up at the most unfortunate moments.
So the job had to be done.
It was screening the aircraft carrier.
Now,
it was immensely boring.
The second thing you mentioned was shore land bombardment.
Yeah. Well, in between the screening the carrier, we would go inshore and anchor or steam up and down near the island of Chodo, which, although being north of beyond the front line in North Korean waters, it was occupied by a United Nations radar station run by the South Koreans, and we were there partially to protect it. There were a lot of mines around there, and so we had also to protect.
Can we stick to the bombardments first? What were you bombarding?
We were bombarding enemy gun positions, troop concentrations. That's about it, actually. or any activity which we observed going on ashore.
There'd be quite a lot of this, wouldn't there?
Oh yes.
I mean, you fired a lot of...
We fired a lot of shells, and I don't think really we achieved anything at all, really. We used to keep them on their toes ashore during the night by firing star shell, just to sort of prevent them getting too much sleep. But we didn't really achieve an awful amount, which is a pity.
Now, you mentioned mines were a problem when you were operating close inshore.
They were the main problem, mines, yes. And they were Russian ground mines, very good ones. Although there were one or two moored mines as well, which were swept.
Now you've got a story about interrogating, you know.
Yes, we. there was a Canadian destroyer, Nootka, I think it was, who was patrolling one night and intercepted a little sampan, sort of open North Korean boat. And so they illuminated it with their searchlight, and the crew jumped overboard and were picked up by the Nootka. And they were taken ashore on the island of Chodo, which, as I say, was manned by the South Koreans. And there they were subjected to rather harsh treatment by some South Korean Marines. Anyway, they were brought out to my ship the next day because it was thought that I, as an underwater warfare specialist, might be interested to talk to these people. There were, I think, four of them. We had on board a South Korean, Korean naval liaison officer, Lieutenant Park Yong-chul. And when these chaps came on board, he took them onto the after gun deck, and they squatted down, and he began to harangue them. And eventually, after about a quarter of an hour or so, he came up to the bridge where I was and reported to me that they were ready for interrogation. So I went down, and he interpreted for me. And they answered all my questions in the most tremendous detail and with no hesitation whatsoever. And eventually they were sent back on shore, I think, under the guard. And later that morning I was up in the water, maybe a glass of gin or something, and I said to this Korean liaison officer, "What were you saying to those guys before I came down?" And he said, "Oh, I told them that you were the most brutal officer in the whole of the Royal Navy. If they told you everything, it would be all right. If not, I would have them hung up by their thumbs until they were dead." I was absolutely aghast. I said, "Heaven's sakes, if ever I'm caught by the North Koreans, you know what will happen to me, don't you?" Anyway, he was quite unabashed, but I thought it rather strange to be known as the most brutal officer in the whole of the Royal Navy. I tell that to others. I say that you don't look that brutal to me. Well, there we are. Such is life.
And another story is about actually bombarding, separate from what we've already discussed, bombarding of a railway line.
Yes. On the east coast of Korea, the railway line runs down...
That's not the Yellow Sea.
No, that's the other side. That's the west, the eastern side. Yes, side facing America. The railway runs down the coast rather like that rail line down the south coast between Tynmouth and Dawlish. Lots of little tunnels and lots of little straight lines. And this was the main supply line, or one of the main supply lines, for the North Korean forces. And so it was rather important to interrupt it if possible. And so from time to time, we were allowed to go around there and have a go at the railway line. And it was rather thrilling. When we go in by night to within about 2,000 or 3,000 yards, let's say a mile, mile and a half, of the railway line, and listen for the train coming. And being an anti-submarine officer, I had really good hearing. I was provided myself with a Bren gun with a magazine full of tracer bullets. And as soon as I saw the train emerging from a tunnel, you see its white smoke coming up, I'd let off an entire magazine of tracer, Around would come our guns, and we would blaze away at his train. The idea, of course, was to hit the locomotive and stop the whole thing. But they were very cunning, the North Koreans, and sometimes they had an engine at both the front and the back of the train. So if you hit the train in the middle, then the other locomotive could tow the remains of the train back into the nearest tunnel. But it was great fun, and we used to rather enjoy it. Of course, by daylight, we would stand out to sea quite a long way, because they had some very the enemy had some very accurate mobile guns ashore. Anyway, we used to keep this up, and on one occasion we'd been doing this for about 3 days, making sure that no traffic passed, until suddenly over the eastern horizon there appeared the enormous enormous American battleship, the USS Iowa, with 9 16-inch guns. And she told us to stand aside, and she proceeded at an enormous range to fire an entire broadside, which removed this train, which we'd stopped, entirely from the track into the paddy field on the inside of the line, which is what the North Koreans had been trying to do for about 3 days. So we didn't think that was terribly clever, but there it was. They thought they'd done a very good job.
Anything else about operations? And you know, this is during the Korean War, the later stages of the Korean War. I would have thought.
Yeah, we weren't there for the end of it, or I wasn't.
Anything else that you remember from that time?
No, nothing in particular.
What was it like at Kure?
Kure.
Sorry, and Takiba.
Sasebo.
Sasebo. Yes.
Well, Kure we went to most of the time. That was the Commonwealth run one. Well, one drank and danced with the taxi dancers. Some went to brothels, some didn't. Generally, they sort of let your hair down. You were there for perhaps 10 days and back out on patrol again.
And anything else about the Cossack then? Or is that about it?
Well, I was eventually relieved in Cossack and came home. Having left HMS Cossack, I went down to Singapore, where I was meant to fly home all the way to England. And I was absolutely thrilled. I sent my heavy baggage ahead and prepared to fly. The day before I was due to take off for England, the first lieutenant of one of the minesweepers went round the bend, and I was told at about 4 hours' notice to take his place. And so instead of going home by air, I had to join HMS Michael, which was a fleet minesweeper, and steam home all the way at about 14 knots, all the way to England. I could have wept. My wife probably did, because I rung her up and said, I'm on my way tomorrow. So there it was. And we came home the hour of the I think Ceylon and Portside, Malta, and finally back to England, where my wife met us when we burst in Portsmouth Dockyard.
You got back about June 1954.
That's right, having been abroad for about 2.5 years.